Oh, say can we see by the one light in all our earth to embrace at the call of all nations where our children can play in a world without war where we stand hand in hand in the grace of creation where the rivers run clean through the forests of green where the cities stand tall in the clear skies of freedom. Oh, say do our hearts sing out for harmony and love forever on the planet of our birth, blessed with peace.
Welcome to Great Speeches and Interviews on Access Sacramento and The Voice. I'm Steve Lerman, and you can hear us at accesssacramento.org, or you can hear this program and past programs at greatspeechesandinterviews.blogspot.com. Today's program includes Hot, Wet, and Uncertain. What do scientists predict the Earth will be like in a few decades? Computer models suggest deterioration of agricultural land, crumbling bridges, flooded roads, and population shifts away from low-lying cities such as Miami and Amsterdam. How fast will the Arctic ice melt? What does this mean for the rest of the world? What are governments and businesses doing in the Bay Area and elsewhere to prepare for new water patterns that paradoxically may bring too much water at times in some areas and drought in others? And then after that, David Suzuki discusses the human environmental crisis and how it could be turned around in a generation.
Welcome to Climate One of the Commonwealth Club. I'm Greg Dalton. Heat waves, melting ice caps, floods, and droughts. Climate models suggest our future will be hot, wet, and very uncertain. How good are those models as predictive tools? What can they tell us about how climate change will impact California, the Bay Area, and your neighborhood? How good are scientists at communicating extremely complex concepts and data to a public that is primarily focused on making ends meet? We have three experts here today to discuss those issues and more with our live audience in San Francisco. Andy Gunther is Executive Director of the Center for Ecosystem Management and Restoration. Wieslaw Maslowski is Research Professor of the Naval Postgraduate School. And Will Travis is Executive Director of the Bay Conservation and Development Commission. Please welcome them to Climate One of the Commonwealth Club. Gentlemen, thank you all for coming. Wieslaw Maslowski, let's start with you. Let's start up north in the Arctic. You're an expert on Arctic ice. How fast is the Arctic ice melting, and what does it mean for the global climate system?
Well, first of all, I wanted to say thank you for inviting me and giving me the opportunity to discuss Arctic issues here in San Francisco Bay. We have meetings here every year in December, American Geophysical Union fall meetings, most of the time a week or 2 weeks before Christmas, on the order of 15 to 20,000 people gather here to discuss the geophysics, but there is a lot of focus recent years on the climate change in the meeting. So San Francisco actually is a center for gathering of the scientific community here on an annual basis to discuss those issues. Going back to the Arctic, there is statistics that can be used to calculate some trends and some numbers to present them in a more quantitative way. Basically, the Arctic sea ice has been melting quite dramatically over the past decades, and most recently over the decade and a half or so, this trend has accelerated. In 2007, compared to the mean ice extent in the Arctic, the summer melt by September of 2007 was around 43% of that mean that is based on the satellite observations going back to late 1970s.
And so that means 47% of it reduction.
Over 40% has been reduced in summer compared to a mean which is based on satellite observations for that month, September, for the past 20-something years. And immediately, I need to discuss a little more details about the way of quantifying those changes, because the satellite can see the two-dimensional changes in the ice, which is defined to be ice extent. Ice extent, if you look at the National Snow and Ice Data Center, nsidc.org, the definition is that this is an area which is encompassed by a 15% ice concentration based on satellite observations. So everything inside a 50% contour is counted as ice extent. However, in the middle of the ice pack, ice is not 100% at 100% concentration. So this ice extent does not represent the total actual ice area, because within the ice extent we have less than 100% coverage. So we need to discuss another term, which is ice area in summer or in winter. And ice area can be well defined in the winter, because most of the ice pack is covered by snow or is very bright and reflective. So there's no uncertainty in estimating the ice concentration during winter. When the melt season comes in the Arctic, which starts sometime around late May, June, on the top of the ice cover, we got melt ponds. And those melt ponds, from the satellite point of view, they look exactly the same like as open ocean. So the difference between the melt ponds for the satellite instrument and the open ocean is none. However, melt ponds will be formed on ice that could be 2-3 meters thick underneath, and the satellite will actually count this area where there is so much ice underneath the melt pond as the open ocean. So ice area and ice concentration estimates during summer, during the melt season, are much more uncertain, which is why NSIDC and other organizations, they prefer to stick to the ice extent, which is just basically determining this 15% concentration contour and qualifying this as the change. Another term which needs to come into play, and I'm trying to be brief, is the ice thickness. So ice extent and ice area gives us only the two-dimensional change information. In order to understand the actual change in the ice volume, we need to understand the changes in area and changes in thickness. Observations of ice thickness are very limited and very recent. We have Navy submarines that would go under the ice in the Arctic, and they have instruments that are looking upward, like a sonar, upward-looking sonar. And the submarine goes underneath the ice, and they can tell you what the ice thickness is along the submarine track. Those are available from basically late 50s through the 2000s. And those are the best data that we have on the ice thickness from the Arctic.
Let me jump in here. What does it mean? So if ice is down dramatically by 50% and there's different measurements and there's imperfections in the tools, what does this mean for the global climate system? The Arctic's often referred to as the Earth's refrigerator or cooling system.
So the point is that once we determine how much ice has been melting in recent times, we can determine how much change in the Earth energy budget is taking place due to the changing the surface in the Arctic. When you have the ice cover surviving the summer in the Arctic, most of the energy which is coming from the solar radiation, on the average 70 to 80% will be returned by the ice cover back to the atmosphere. When we replace a large portion of this the surface by a dark open ocean, the absorption goes from 70-80% reflectivity to 70-80% absorption. So basically, we absorb much more energy from the sun, and the Arctic has been in the past considered to be a buffer for Earth climate. because the warmer water by the ocean were moved, advected to the north, both to the south and to the northern polar hemisphere, and they were cooled along the way. And then we had the blanket at the surface, which is the sea ice and the snow on top of it, which would actually prevent much of the exchange of this warmer water, which is traveling into the Arctic and the Southern Ocean, to the surface. So the heat was not removed and was trapped in the deep ocean for a long time. Now, as we melt the sea ice in the northern hemisphere, basically we not only have a chance to remove this heat from the surface ocean, but we also during the summer can absorb a lot of heat into the ocean and change the energy balance.
And what do the models say about how this will affect California?
Well, that's a very difficult question to answer, I guess. The models that are state-of-the-art models, they're global models, and they're designed to run centennial simulations. So most of the time, global climate models will start sometime in the late 19th century, and they'll run for the past 130, 140 years, and then we'll run a couple hundred years forward in terms of understanding where the climate will go based on those simulations. So the reason I'm explaining that the long-term simulations and global aspect of global climate models is that by necessity, the capability of current computational resources, those models have a rather low resolution in space. Typical grid cell of a global climate model can be on the order of 100 to 200 kilometers on the side. So from the...
So they don't answer the local question yet. So Andy Gunther, there's a gap there between where the models are, and you're involved with the Union of Concerned Scientists and have a PhD yourself. How are we going to fill that gap between what the models are capable of doing and policymakers who need information to act specifically and locally in a time frame that's not decades and centuries, which is the way the climate models work?
That is definitely one of the great challenges that we face from a modeling perspective, is if a global climate model is going to give us an average number for temperature in a box that is 200 kilometers on a side, that's much, much larger than most of our political institutions have to think. So the problem becomes a problem, in essence, of risk assessment. And the problem, you have to then look and say what might happen and make a balanced judgment about whether or not the costs of that event, you have consequences times frequency, and that generates your impact. And so even low frequency events that have very high consequences can produce great cost. So you have to make that assessment. We do this all the time. We do this all the time. We have, I don't know what the chances are of your home burning down, but you have mm-hmm. fire insurance. And in fact, you never stop to think about that. You think that it's worth it to do that. Most of the economic analysis, in fact, virtually all of the economic analyses, are telling us that the projected costs in the future of doing nothing far exceed the investments we have to make now in order to take steps to minimize that risk. If we wait until we have perfect information, I mean, as Wislaw pointed out, global climate models are pushing the actual computing resources available to us. It's an enormously complex undertaking to just process that much information. So if we wait, waiting and not doing anything is in essence making that risk, taking that risk assessment and saying that I think the risk of action now is much greater than the risk of inaction. And yet everything that I read in the scientific literature and including, you know, economic analyses are pointing us in the other direction, which is that the cost of inaction, the risk of inaction, is actually much greater than any cost associated with taking action now.
Will Travis, your job is to interact with lots of local and state and regional policymakers. How are they responding to the time frame and uncertainty of the climate models within the constraints of their jobs?
Well, first off, Greg, thank you for inviting me. I have to admit that when you said you wanted me to come up to the Mid-Market Street area to participate in an event called Hot, Wet, and Uncertain, I was expecting something else. But nonetheless.
Anything you'd like to do up here on stage, Will, for a little adult entertainment on Market Street? Yeah.
We're dealing with local governments here in the Bay Area. We have 55 local governments that border San Francisco Bay and probably several hundred special districts that deal with a whole variety of things. And when you talk to their engineers, you say, well, we're going to have a problem here in the Bay Area. We're going to have sea level rise. And the answer or the question they give me is, how much and how soon? And we have to say, well, we don't know precisely. But one of the things that I think is pushing the Bay Area to the forefront nationally and internationally in dealing with sea level rise adaptation is the legacy of our history. The Bay that we have today is a third smaller than it was at the time that California became a state. And it was filled. There were landfill operations. All of that land was filled just high enough to get it above sea level of the past. We know we're going to have accelerated sea level rise. We just don't know exactly how much. But to some degree, it doesn't matter all that much. Because all you need to do is get the sea levels up over the front lip of the landfill, and all of a sudden you see that downtown San Francisco and San Francisco and Oakland International Airports and a place which used to be called the Valley of Heart's Delight, which was fruit orchards where they irrigated the fruit orchards with well water and extracted the water and the ground level sank, which is now called Silicon Valley, is all in danger of inundation. We're using a rough approximation of about 4/10 of a meter of sea level rise by about mid-century, give or take 10 or 15 years, and about 1.4 meters by the end of the century. It's very interesting when you map those two areas. There's about an 84% correlation. So once the water gets up over the level of the filled area, it tracks back to the natural contours of the original bay shoreline. And over time, it will simply get deeper. So the Bay Area here, the local governments are trying to respond to this, but they are also having to deal with the fact that they're laying off cops and firefighters, and they don't have enough money to keep the teachers in school in the fall. So the sense seems to be this is a very critical problem. Call me when you have some money to deal with it.
We've been talking about Arctic ice. There's also snowpack in the Sierra as a big part of the the water system, free storage for California's water system. Wieslaw Maslowski, do your models have any correlation to what will happen with snowpack in mountain areas of the western United States?
Well, my models are focusing on the Arctic, but I know that the global climate models predict that with climate warming, there will be much more extreme and much more variability in any part of the world. So basically, like we've experienced last winter, very cold weather on the East Coast, and now we're experiencing very warm weather on the East Coast. This kind of events will probably be occurring much more often, frequently, and throughout the whole Earth.
And Andy Gunther, when that happens, some people say, oh, global warming's over because it snowed in Washington.
Well, weather and climate are not the same things. And indeed, the heat wave currently on the East Coast is not any sort of proof of global warming. You need to look at three decades of temperatures to see that, in fact, the planet is warming. With regards to the Sierras, I think it's very, very important for us to recognize that our water system is devised around the snowpack. So the snowpack is a reservoir, and the water builds up over the winter, and then we capture it in the spring, and we use it in the summer and the fall, and then we count on it building up again in the winter. And we've devised our water system around the Mother Nature's reservoir. Now, what the models predict for us here is that we will get more precipitation. There'll be more variable precipitation, as Wiesla pointed out, but we'll also get more of our precipitation as rain instead of snow. Another way of thinking about that is the average snow level in the Sierras will be higher. And so what that means is we then have runoff in the winter that we didn't used to have, and then we have less water in the spring and summer. So we will see less water available for our uses in the spring and the summer, and we will have more winter flooding. And we will get some of these events like happened in 1997 in the San Joaquin Basin when we had rain on the snowpack, and that generates a tremendous flood that we had barely had the capacity to move past Fresno before it spread out over the San Joaquin Valley. And so those kind of shifts. And I also think it's important to recognize that this doesn't mean that one day you're going to go into the kitchen and you're going to turn on the sink and no water is going to come out. Most of our water goes to agriculture, and of our residential water use, about half of it goes to landscaping. And so there's a fabulous article, I thought, that was written by the Chronicle Environmental Reporter, whose name I should absolutely know, because it's, can you believe it? I'm referring to someone's work, and I can't remember their name. It'll come to me in a minute. It's called The Great Thirst. And it's a future history. So it was written from 2050, looking back at 2034 in California, and talks about both the impacts of floods and droughts. And it's written in a very, very accessible manner. But one of the things that he points out is that in 2050, one of the great signs of affluence is going to be a lawn.
AstroTurf lawn, perhaps, or you're talking about a real lawn.
Yeah. No. I'm talking about a real lawn. That as our climatic regime shifts here in California, it'll be harder and harder to make California look like England, lawns are a real cultural part of our world, but it's going to be harder and harder to find the water to keep that grass alive, both because we'll have to start making decisions about where water goes, but also because the climate will be shifting in a way that will put even more stress on those grasses. Thank you.
now for something completely different.